Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 24, 18. Yad upadaya purvastu. Bhavo vikuru te param. Adhiranto idharyasya. Tatsacham mahavidhiyate. Yet. Which form?
Which form?
Upadaya. Accepting as the ingredient cause. Purvaha.
The previous cause.
Such as the Mahatattva.
Such as the Mahatattva.
To.
To.
And.
And.
Bhavaha.
Thing.
Vikurute.
Vikurute.
Produces as transformation.
Aparam.
The second thing. Such as the element ahankara.
Adi.
The beginning. Antaha.
The end.
Yada.
When.
Yasya.
Of which product?
That. That cause. Satcham.
Real.
Avidhiyate.
Is called.
Translation. A material object, itself composed of an essential ingredient, creates another material object through transformation. Thus, one created object becomes the cause and basis of another created object. A particular thing may thus be called real in that it possesses the basic nature of another object that constitutes its origin and final state. Purport. One may understand the purport of this verse through the simple analogy of a clay pot. A clay pot is formed from a lump of clay which is itself prepared from the earth. In this case, earth is the original ingredient forming the clay lump, and the clay lump is in a sense the original cause of the pot. When the pot is destroyed, we will again assume the designation clay and ultimately merge back into the earth, its original cause. In relation to the clay pot, clay is the beginning and final state. Thus the pot is called real, for it possesses the essential characteristics of clay, which exist before and after the existence of the functioning instrument known as the pot. Similarly, earth exists before and after the clay, and thus clay may be considered real because it possesses the essential characteristics of earth, which exists before and after the existence of the clay. Similarly, earth and other elements are created from the Mahatattva, which exists before and after the existence of the elements, which may be considered real because they possess the essential characteristics of the Mahatattva. The Mahatattva is ultimately the creation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes, who exists after all is annihilated. The Absolute Truth is the Supreme Lord Himself, who step by step gives meaning and character to all that exists. Yad upadaya purvastu bhavo vikurute param adhiranto idharyasya tatsacham abhidhiyate. A material object, itself composed of an essential ingredient creates another material object through transformation. Thus one created object becomes the cause and basis of another created object. A particular thing may thus be called real in that it possesses the basic nature of another object that constitutes its origin and final state. Can I get a bag of the Gita? Gita? In this verse, Lord Sri Krishna is speaking to Uddhava about the philosophy of Sankhya, an analytical study of the elements that make up reality, and by understanding the different elements or ingredients of reality, one can understand reality. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, these statements, of course, are all confirmed by Krishna's own personal statements in the Bhagavad Gita as well. And here, Krishna is actually expanding the same information. We see that Krishna says to Arjuna in the 7th chapter, it says, Jnanam te ham savijnanam idam bhakshami sishyataha yaj gatvane habuyon yaj gatavyam avasishyate. I shall now declare unto you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I will tell you the different ingredients of reality, and when you know this, you will know everything that needs to be known. So then he describes those ingredients. First he describes the material ingredients. In text 4, Bhumirapo nalo vayo kammano buddhirevicha ahankara iti yamme vina prakriti astada. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego, altogether these eight constitute my separated material energies. And then in the next verse, text 5, he describes the spiritual element. Apariyam itas tanyam praktim vidime param jivabhutam mahabaho yedam dharyate jagat. Besides these, O mighty armed Arjuna, there is another superior energy of mind which comprises the living entities who are exploiting the resources of this material inferior nature. So there he describes the jivas, or the spirit souls, which are also part of his energy, but his superior energy. And then in text 6 he sums up that Itadjonini bhutani saravanichu padaraya aham krishnasya jagatha prabhava palayastata. All created beings have their source in these two natures. Of all that is material and all that is spiritual in this world, know for certain that I am both the origin and dissolution. So, same thing which is stated here in this verse, that a particular thing may thus be called real in that it possesses the basic nature of another object that constitutes its origin and final state. And Krishna is saying that he is the origin and final state of all material and spiritual manifestations that we see. So it is the same teaching that Krishna is giving in Bhagavad Gita that he is expanding here. And this is the philosophy of Sankhya, and ultimately the philosophy of Sankhya, by understanding the ingredients of reality, we can understand the nature of reality itself. And of course, if we understand reality, it means that we're not bewildered. If we don't understand reality, it means that we may be bewildered. So, therefore, we see in verse 13 that Krishna describes how people are bewildered. He says, Tribhya guna maya bhave abhya saravam idam jagat mohitam navijanati mamebhya param avyayam. Deluded by the three modes, goodness, passion and ignorance, the whole world does not know me, who am above the modes and inexhaustible. So Krishna is describing how people become enchanted. Bewilderment is another word we can use, Prabhupada uses in that purport, is enchantment. When one becomes enchanted by something, it means that they become absorbed in that particular aspect, and they may forget about other aspects that are there. So, for instance, to give an example, we know that these days they want to put, well, they may have already done it, they want to put plain packaging on cigarettes, because people become enchanted by the packaging. Previously, people would look at the packet, and the packet would remind them that, I can be the Marlboro man, the riding on the horse out in the country, the big cowboy. So, people who used to smoke, I don't know if they even have those cigarettes, but people who smoke Marlboro, they used to, be enchanted by the notion that, yes, I am the big cowboy type of person and I smoked a Marlboro, like this. And others would smoke Peter Stuyvesant's or something, and they are the cosmopolitan traveller, and so, but it's all in the packaging. So now what they do, of course, is that they don't want people to be enchanted by the packaging, because becoming enchanted by the packaging, they can't see what's actually in there, which is what they should be looking at. That what is in the packet is poison that will kill you. See? So in the same way, Krishna is saying that everyone is enchanted by the modes of material nature. The modes of goodness, passion and ignorance, they create, each have an enchantment for a particular type of person according to their desires to enjoy in a particular way. And those three modes of material nature, they manifest, because when you, if you take the three modes of material nature and you mix them in different combinations, three by three, you get nine. So nine different combinations, but just like you mix primary colours, red, yellow and blue, that you mix them, and then you get your secondary colours, and then you mix those nine by three, or actually even by nine, you can get 81 different varieties. So actually, if you keep mixing the modes of material nature, you end up with 8,400,000 different species of life. 8,400,000 different species of life is the, you keep multiplying the combinations of the modes, mixing them, and you get 8,400,000 species, which accommodates very sufficiently all the particular types of enchantments or different types of packaging for the living entity. So the living entity can be packaged in a certain way. And the living entities are very enchanted by that packaging. not realizing that by accepting one of the different 8,400,000 different species of life, they're actually drinking poison. Mm. Yeah, it's described by Narottam Das Thakur that you know, I have this human form of life, but being enchanted by this material body, I've knowingly drunk poison in the form of karma, yoga, jnana, and in this way I've wasted my whole life and have not taken the real opportunity to serve Sri Sri Radha Krishna at that. So in this way people become bewildered or enchanted by particular modes of material nature, and their consciousness becomes absorbed, and therefore they fail to see other things, aspects of reality, which they should be looking at, which they should be focusing on. We see that in many different ways, just like the Titanic. Supposed to be the most luxurious ocean liner of its time, back in 1912, and of course people were enchanted by, you know, the way it was decked out for the very wealthy people. You know, it was the opulence, you know, the carpets and, you know, marble and, you know, the cutlery and the, you know, dining halls and the dancing halls and the chandeliers and, you know, all the polished wood, everything like that. So they're enchanted by that. But of course, what you forget is that, you know, you're basically, you know, going to ride out into the middle of the icy seas, you know, in a large chunk of steel and iron, and hope that you don't end up in the water. And that, you know, that's the thing that is forgotten. And ultimately, the Titanic really just proved to be one very elaborately designed coffin that took over 1,500 people to their watery grave. We see also with you know, cars. Cars are also, you know, very much like that. That people, you know, they become enamored that, you know, this car has, you know, CD stacker, and it has, you know, cushioned seats and like this, and, you know, particular type of colour, you know, like this. But you know, they're For many, you know, they're really just a coffin on wheels. They're just, you know, hurtling to their death. The same, you know, when we get into a plane. You know, you get into a plane and people, are, you know, want to know, what is the service like? What is the cabin service like? And, you know, so many things like this. But, you know, apart from all of that, you're literally in a tin can, you know, hurtling through the air, you know, at 1,000 miles an hour, and just hoping that you don't hit anything and that you know, you can come down safely. So, and we see, because people put their faith in these things, but it doesn't take much for you know, people becoming enamored. The scientists also are very, very clever at making people enchanted by something and hiding the real dangers that lie within. it's like ultimately, actually, with the Titanic, what happened was that it wasn't necessarily the iceberg which sank the Titanic. It was the fact that they used the ship was actually made out of steel, but they used iron, what are they called, cast iron rivets, because it was too difficult to. They could have used steel, but it was a very difficult process to get the steel rivets into it, and they used cast iron. And on top of that, they used the cheaper form of cast iron rivets, which has more impurities in it, so therefore it, you know, the head of the rivets pop off quite easily. And of course they when usually if a ship hits an iceberg straight on, they'll still, even with massive damage, it will actually just be able to sail back to, you know, land and what have you. But because they actually swerved away and hit it side on, all the rivets just popped. And as the people said, there was hardly even any movement. No one hardly even noticed that there was a bang. You see on the, you know, in the, when they show the documentaries, people flying here and everywhere. But actually, they grazed the iceberg with, and people never even noticed hardly that they hit it. But because of the rivets, we were second class, it just a little bit of pressure was able to peel off a massive big hole, and then the whole thing you know, sunk very quickly. So so you know, it doesn't take much for all the you know, fanfare that, you know, here is the unsinkable, you know, Titanic and what have you. People become enchanted by that. And then, of course, you know, to show their confidence, they will deck it out. Of course, if you have a ship that you know that may sink, you know, you push it out into the open, you're not going to fill it up with, you know, millions of dollars worth of the most finest, you know, luxuries, you know, known to man, you know. So that, of course, builds up people's confidence. You know, this ship must be wonderful. You know, there's no way. Look at all the luxury. There's no way they will put all this luxury on a ship if it's going to sink. But actually, it was people were falsely enchanted and sent to their grave. So, in this way, understanding, you know. In every, generally people, if they consider that in order to make right choices, in order to protect themselves, in order to protect others, in order to protect their nation, in order to go through life properly, people naturally want to inquire about the nature of things. By understanding, you know, if you purchase something, or if you're going to utilize some machinery or some equipment, you know, you naturally want to know, you know, what it is composed of, what it is made of, you know, how much use you can get out of it, how you can use it, ways that you can't use it. You know, don't submerge this in water, don't get this wet, don't, you know, you get a mobile phone or something and they will tell you that, you know, keep it away from certain conditions. So, you know, that's natural because the, you know, the components of it, you know, can only take certain situations. So that's very, very natural to understand these things. But the nature of the material energy is to bewilder the living entities so that those things which they need to know, they generally don't think of because they're enchanted. That's actually the very nature of the material energy. There is a, it has two potencies. The material energy, one potency is literally, you know, the potency to throw the living entity into, you know, material existence, into, and to cover the living entity in one of the 8,400,000 different species of life. No one can stop that. No one can say that, you know, I will not take, you know, birth again. You know, just like no one can say, I will not get old. You cannot stop the material energy. It will act. Everyone will have to get old, whether they like it or not. The material energy will force that. So material energy has that power. The material energy can place you into a material body. And the other part of the material energy's potency is its bewildering aspect, that we become enchanted and completely absorbed, enamored in that particular covering of the modes of material nature. We see that Indra? You know, Indra was once cursed, and he had to take birth as a pig. So he had to suffer for some very great offence. So then, when his suffering was finished, I think it was Lord Brahma came and and said, "Well, now you can come back to your post." But Indra was now enchanted by the life of a pig. He had his little piggy wife and his little piggy children and his little piggy playpen, and his swill, and some mud to roll, and he was enchanted. That is the nature of the material energy. So Brahma literally had to shock him back into reality, and then he happily returned back to the spiritual world. But the material energy, that is the nature of material existence. And those who are agents of the material energy, they act on behalf. They're instruments in the hands of Maya, just like one can be an instrument in the hands of Krishna to present transcendental knowledge of devotional service. One can also be an instrument in the hands of Maya by force to cover over actual knowledge. So therefore, anyone who is under the influence of the modes of material nature, especially the lower modes of material nature, they're to one degree or another bewildered. Those in the modes of passion are bewildered, those in the mode of ignorance are more bewildered. Even those in the mode of goodness are bewildered, but not as bewildered as those in the lesser modes. That is why only the brahmanas should teach. No one else can actually teach. No one in a Vedic society, only the brahmanas are allowed to teach, because they are considered to be the least bewildered, the very, very close to, because they understand the difference between Brahman or spirit and matter. Of course, the Vaishnavas, they fully understand spirit, all the way up to Bhagavan. But the Brahmanas generally, at least they have some understanding of matter and spirit, and therefore they're able to teach. Others are to some degree bewildered, and their knowledge has no value. Therefore we see that, although people learn generally these days from the scientists, there's no value. There's no value in the scientific knowledge, because their knowledge will change. If you take knowledge, if you take knowledge 10 years ago, then they will put this in the textbooks, and this is the way everything is in this universe. And then 2 years later they change, and then they change again. Actually, I saw a documentary the other day where one of the leading scientists of the world, they're describing the Big Bang Theory. And he said that, the more we realise about the nature, the more we learn, the more we realise how many mistakes we've made. And he said that we know that the more we understand in the future, we will be proved wrong. But we don't mind being proved wrong because that means we're learning more. So this is the mentality. But understand, of course, that if you are constantly being proved wrong, how can you ever come to the point of knowledge? Right? If your process is that for me to come to the point of real knowledge, I need all my illusions, I need to make so many mistakes, and those mistakes realize that I'm not at the point of knowledge yet. But if that process just continues on, and we keep making mistakes and illusions, then we can never come to the point of knowledge. And as Krishna says here, that verse we quoted, no one can understand me who am beyond the modes and inexhaustible. So it is not possible for one with limited intelligence, covered by the limited material senses, to ever come to the platform of knowledge of the inexhaustible Supreme Lord. Even knowledge of just one part of his energies, the material energies, because it's coming from the Supreme, inexhaustible Supreme Lord, one cannot even know his material energies, let alone his spiritual energies, let alone the Supreme Lord, who is the origin and dissolution of everything, and who is the very source of creation, going back all eternity. It is not possible for a limited, tiny, conditioned soul to actually come to that point of knowledge. Therefore, we see that the more the scientists actually try to understand about the universe, the more they understand that there is something so much beyond. We come to this point of understanding, and all they do is that they realize then it's just made us realize that there's just so much more to understand. And then if they can ever get to that point, that yes, we've understood that which we, vast, covered so much knowledge since then. And then they look over the precipice and they see, now there is so much more to understand. Therefore, I think was it Einstein and Newton who said, in the course of his lifetime, he'd simply managed to gather up a few pebbles on the shore of the ocean of knowledge. So he was a wise man. He understood. And even today people struggle to understand some of these previous scientists, realizations and understandings and theories. But he understood that, simply everything we know is just a few pebbles. It adds up to nothing. It's just like the Big Bang Theory that, they say that everything, that the material universe was created, manifested through the Big Bang. So, all the ingredients of creation were in this conglomerate, condensed form, which exploded or imploded, creating all the different elements and planets, and satellites, so many different things within the universe as we know today. So, of course, they cannot explain such a theory, but it doesn't actually explain anything, because if we say so, then where did the ingredients come from? Then there's nothing. The other thing which they also say is that when the Big Bang happened, that there must have been some other massive potency present that they're not aware of, that they have no idea what it could be, that literally distributed the ingredients of the Big Bang throughout the universe. So, you know, if we can imagine, you know, give an example that sometimes you see they will take a large building and they will blow it up. All the bricks come falling down and the dust, it may spread for one block. But then if we see that some force has spread that dust and those bricks to every part of the universe, every part of the world, then you have to understand. So what happened? What other force was there? Because how did this brick, you know, from the building in Melbourne, one's ended up in Iceland, another one's in the South Pole, what force distributed to such a massive scale? So, you know, they understand that the Big Bang doesn't really explain anything. It still points to the fact that there is some supreme power, you know, manifesting, you know, where did the ingredients come from? And, something else, some superior power is there beyond the Big Bang, you know, which they can't even contemplate. It just, you know, they can't even enter into an understanding what it could be. So, but they're, as I say, they're happy to search for this knowledge, you know, for years and years and years, and they're quite happy that, you know, they'll be proved wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong and like this, because they feel that, just like a salesman, that, you knock on a door, you try to sell something, and every time someone says no, you feel that, yes, eventually you'll get a sale because, you know, 1 in 100 people buy something. So if you get 99 no's, you're confident that the next one should buy something. The process is like the optimistic salesman, that if we keep, you know, making fools out of ourselves, ultimately we'll come to be wise men. So there is some logic there within that. But Krishna has a different opinion, and he thinks that people who think like that are mudhas. They're fools, but they're not just fools, they're rascals as well. And so that is Krishna's opinion. We see that even the scientists, they want to understand the nature of the ingredients, you know, how they're put together, and what is the nature of reality. But of course their process is imperfect, but the fact that they want to understand is good. It's just that their process is imperfect, but that it is normal for everyone to properly understand the nature of things, because then one can utilize everything properly. And if one understands the nature of things, then, you know, it is less likely one will be cheated, bewildered, enchanted. To give another example, how we were discussing how those who do not follow the Vedic scriptures and do not systematically learn them, in other words, those who do not come to the Brahminical platform, they cannot teach and their knowledge is useless. That was the point we were making. So we discussed about the scientists. Generally we consider people who have knowledge to be Brahminical or Brahmanas or intellectuals, factually. But if one does not have real knowledge and one is teaching, actually they're Sudras or less. Quite often we kindly, you know, say that our professors and teachers in the universities and what have you, we sort of kindly describe them as being something like Brahminical section of society, but actually they're also just because they have no real knowledge. But because they're teaching, they're actually acting as instruments or agents in the hands of Maya to bewilder. That's one of Maya's jobs. One of her potencies is that she can bewilder the living entities. We see just like these days there is a campaign to find out what are the ingredients in food, because you know, people like to people who manufacture food these days, they like to you know, enchant everyone with the labels and the packaging, but they don't want people to know what's in the can. They actually, you know, they want to bewilder people. They're acting, you know, as agents of Maya to enchant people, to bewilder people. these days there's one campaign that palm oil, of course, some of our most wonderful natural forests, the best in the world, are being destroyed, you know, and of course all the natural habitat, all the animals and, you know, insects and birds are all being destroyed to the point where I think there's some alarming statistic, you know, every day there's two or three species of, you know, become extinct, you know. Just that's what we're doing at the moment. One of the biggest offenders in that is palm oil. Palm oil, just they grow the palm oil plantations. They just mow down, you know, thousands and thousands of acres of pristine, you know, tropical forests and that, and just put up these palm trees, and they, you know, for the palm oil, which is found in packaging. And but many people who know how devastating it is to the planet to, you know, buy palm oil, they won't buy it. But you don't know where it is because they label it as just vegetable oil. So now they actually, you know, they want to make it legal, that they're trying, although it's very difficult, that if something is an ingredient, the people have a right to know exactly what it is. Now, just like chemicals, so many different chemicals in food. So people want to know that, you know, this chemical has been banned in so many different countries around the world, but if you change the number or the name, it can be freely distributed to our children in Australia. So they want to change the laws so that, you know, you can actually know. So it's actually very important to understand the nature of reality. And here, you know, the reason that Krishna, of course, is describing Sankhya Yoga is because in the previous chapters, Krishna has said to Uddhava that you fix your mind upon me. So, you know, people may think, well, that is unreasonable. You know, why should we think of this, you know, Indian cowherd boy? You know, I'm a, you know, I was born in a different part of the world, or, you know, so they cannot appreciate. But Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita that literally all of reality only consists of his energies, and therefore fixing your mind upon the Supreme Lord, Lord Sri Krishna, is fixing your mind upon reality. It's not an illusion. It's not something mythical. It's not a fantasy. Here in this chapter, Krishna is explaining that you, at first, you may not be able to see the links between Krishna, the cowherd boy, and, you know, the different material elements. So he's pointing out how one particular element, its existence in reality is because its cause is there in the beginning and its cause is there in the end. So therefore it's non-different from its cause, and that cause also is real because it's there in the beginning, it's there throughout, and it's there in the end. So it's always existing. So if we trace the example given here, the clay pot, so then if we look at what makes the clay pot, we see that in the beginning there was clay, the clay pot remains clay, and at the end, when the clay pot is finished, it returns to clay. So the clay pot has its existence, and its existence is non-different from its cause, which is also real, because it was there in all stages. And then we see the clay pot, that before the clay there was the earth, during the clay it was the earth, and then after the clay it goes back to earth. And then if we take each of these successive elements of creation, all being identified, and you go back, you can see that they're all resting upon the energy of Krishna, the Supreme Lord, in the form of ultimately his material energy and his spiritual energy, and that those energies are resting upon him. So in the beginning it may be difficult, especially if we're enchanted and just absorbed in one particular aspect of the bewildering varieties of material world as the all in all, and our whole life is devoted to that enchanting, bewildering aspect of the material nature, then we're not even inclined to go beyond that. But if we do want to go, you know, look at each one and not stop on the way being enchanted, and we look at what is the cause of this, what is the cause of this, ultimately you come back to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in this way, the Sankhya philosophy is saying, the Krishna is saying, I said to fix my mind upon me, and you know, you may not understand how I am everything in reality, but if you stop being enchanted for some time and just keep looking at the successive causes, you will ultimately get to me. That is the link. It's not so difficult to perceive. And of course, if we actually do that, then we realize that everything ultimately belongs to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everything is his property. And of course, this is another reason why people don't want to look. Right? Just like a thief. You know, if a thief is walking down the street and a thief sees a $100 note lying, he doesn't want to know who owns that money. That's the last thing he wants to know. He doesn't even want to think about it. He just wants to take it for himself. No. You know, I'm the proprietor, I found it. And of course, that's what's called theft by finding. Theft by finding. That's a fact. If you, even in Australia, if you find anything and you keep that, you'll be charged as a thief, a theft by finding. Here in Australia. And in previous, actually I heard a class the other day, Srila Prabhupada was describing that in Kashmir, previously, which was, you know, particularly well known for its strictness, that he said that, gold bracelets could be just left on the ground and no one would touch it. No one would touch it. Because the rule was theft, even by finding. What to speak of, you know, purposely. And if someone picked that bracelet up and kept it, they would have their hand chopped off. And by theft by phone, no one would steal anything. So, so of course, there's a certain reluctance or stubbornness to accept that we're not the lords of all we purvey, but the yes, if we do look back to the original cause, we will find that everything belongs to the Supreme Lord. the so they're called they're the bogies, the material enjoyers. They're actually thieves, and they have the thief mentality. Then you have the impersonalist, so-called transcendentalist. So they analyze the ingredients of material existence, because by analyzing the ingredients of material existence, we can also become detached from the material world and attached to spirit, because we see that one is inferior and one is superior. This is another benefit by understanding the nature of the ingredients. That if we examine that is which is material, it is temporary, whereas that which is spiritual is eternal, so it's superior. That which is material is inert, unconscious matter, whereas that which is spiritual is conscious. And therefore that which is material is has no bliss, whereas that which is conscious and eternal is blissful. So by analysing the ingredients of existence, we can determine, oh, here is the superior thing, the spirit, and the inferior thing is the matter. So the bogies, they want to enjoy the inferior material energy. Some of them want to do that piously. In other words, they want to recognize that everything belongs to God and enjoy the quota which He gives. And others want to not recognize the Supreme Lord and just take what they can without asking. But the renunciates, those who want to seek transcendental life, and yet they also, because there's some envy there, they're not inclined to understand that they're not God. They still, having failed to enjoy the material world as bogies, they want to be the enjoyer in the sense of becoming God or becoming one with God. So if they walk past and they see the $100 note lying on the ground, they will renounce it. So I renounce that $100. But that $100 is not theirs to renounce. In fact, they could be doing someone a great injustice by, not... Just like if you you're walking along and you see someone's keys. There's someone's house keys, their car keys, and you can understand if this person, loses these, it's just going to create, so much inconvenience for that person. So if you see them, you pick them up and you think, let us find out who the owner is, because we don't want to inconvenience them and everyone, related to them. So... but if you think, oh, there are the car keys, I renounce those car keys. I am detached. It has no value. It has no value. It's not yours to renounce. And it's actually causing someone, that artificial renunciation is actually causing other people trouble. Everything in this world has a use. And that use is so that all living entities can enjoy the facilities that they need to exist in this world, and at the same time make progress on the spiritual path. And if everything is not utilized for that purpose, you're actually doing someone some harm by depriving them of facilities that should be distributed throughout the world for their benefit. So that sort of renunciation is not very commendable. But the devotees, they will see that $100 note or those car keys, and they will try to return that to the owner so that it can be used for the purpose intended, and that way no one becomes inconvenienced, either by stealing it or just by leaving something valuable which needs to be utilized in some way. So again, by understanding the nature of reality, all the ingredients, all the components, everything can actually be utilized properly, and the ultimate ingredient is Krishna himself, and Krishna is the source of all other ingredients, and therefore a devotee who understands that, they can actually utilize everything in the service of Krishna without any false renunciation, and in that way they do not become falsely enchanted, they do not become thieves, they do not become false renunciates, and they become very, very dear to Lord Sri Krishna. Those who become enchanted by not understanding the inferiority of material life and become attached to it, they can never make progress in spiritual life. You know, Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter. That's the danger. If we don't even understand to that point that material existence is an inferior situation which is full of misery, all material ingredients, however they're packaged, the material ingredients will cause trouble. they're packaged in different ways, so many different ways. Packaged as brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, sudras, men, women, and so many different species of life. But each and every one of those material bodies will cause suffering. It will cause death. Each of those material bodies will cause birth, death, old age, and disease, without a fact. Repeatedly, for millions and millions of lifetimes. that's the reality of being in a material body, is that you must die. You must suffer disease, old age, so many problems. And everything you become attached to must be taken off you. Everything. Every single thing in the material world. That's a fact. That's what they call a tragic comedy. Everything we become attached to must be taken off. So, the material world is a material body. It's an inferior situation. If we become attached to that, and we have no, therefore, enchanted, and do not become enchanted by the spiritual energy, the spiritual elements, we can never make progress. So as Prabhupada says, he nicely puts it, that attachment to matter, an attachment to spirit, they don't go hand in hand. And we have that example with Sanatana Goswami, that Sanatana Goswami had a touchstone, and a touchstone, of course, can produce so many, so much gold. The yogis, know how to use them. They're certain. But he kept it where the rubbish was kept. Anyway, someone heard that he had this touchstone, and they came and asked Sanatana Goswami, I've heard you have this most valuable thing. Oh, yes, I have the most valuable thing. And then he inquired about the touchstone. And he informed them that that is not the most valuable thing. If you want the most valuable thing, you have to take this touchstone and throw it in the, in the river, yeah. So, he did. He took that touchstone and he threw it in the river, and then he came back to Sanatana Goswami and he asked him, you give me the most valuable thing. And he gave him, the chanting of the holy name and service to Lord Sri Krishna, because that is, gave him the opportunity to experience eternal blissful life you know, on the spiritual platform. So, you know, we cannot be attached to matter and at the same time make progress in spiritual life. Prabhupada gives another example that a woman cannot be attached to two men. If she is married and she has a paramour, her attachment to that paramour will increase moment by moment, day by day. She cannot be attached. So in the same way, if we are trying to make advancement in spiritual life, but we're actually attached to enjoying the material energy, that attachment will just increase. And we will not get anywhere in spiritual life. So understanding, you know, the nature of the ingredients of reality helps us to become detached from the material world. But more so, when we understand all the way to Krishna, so it's not good enough just to understand, because then we become like the false renunciate. They can understand the difference between matter and spirit, and they artificially give up that which is not even theirs, and they do not know how to use everything in the service of the Lord. So we don't want to become like that. So we have to understand the ingredients of reality all the way to the original cause, which is Lord Sri Krishna. And if we understand to that point, then we'll actually become attached to Lord Sri Krishna. And by becoming attached to Krishna, automatically detachment from the material world will be there without any separate endeavor. And if we actually do not come to that point of attachment to Krishna, all artificial attempts at giving up or renouncing the material world will end in failure. And ultimately, you know, one will oscillate, the bhoga charg. Unless one is on the platform of attachment to Krishna, one will enjoy, renounce. Enjoy, suffer, renounce. You know, then suffer in renunciation, enjoy. And this bhoga charg, like this, back, forward. Only until the attachment to the Supreme Lord manifests within one's heart will one actually be fixed on the transcendental platform. Therefore, Krishna says, surrender to me. In that same 7th chapter, in the 14th verse, Krishna says, only those who have surrendered unto me, only they can cross beyond the material energy. Now, no others can do that. And therefore, in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Sarvadamam Purikyagya, Mamikam Saranam Braja, you know, you surrender unto me, give up all your other activities of being the bogi, or the chagi, you know, or the bogi yogi. You give up all these different things. None of them will actually deliver you if you surrender to me. And how is that? He's saying you always think of me, always think of Krishna. And as we've said, one may say to think of Krishna that is unreasonable, but Krishna is explaining here that's not unreasonable. I am the cause of everything. I am the ultimate ingredient. You just have to look at that. Look carefully and you'll see. So, in this way, Krishna gives us an instruction to always think of me. And if one accepts that from the very beginning, even without any further studies or reading, then one immediately comes to the transcendental platform. If one always thinks of Krishna, one will always be thinking of the supreme transcendental reality, and one's detachment from the material world will automatically be there, even if one is not a scholar, even if one is not very well read or philosophical. Krishna gives the instruction, and if one does it immediately, like that. Or if someone thinks this is a very unreasonable, how can Krishna demand this? Such an unreasonable person he is. You know, how can he say that I should surrender unto him and always think of him? If one wants to, you know, philosophically inquire, then there is, if you look properly, without stopping at some enchanted forest somewhere, and keep looking at the cause and the cause and the cause until you get to the ultimate cause, you will come to Krishna and then you'll see, yes, that is quite reasonable. I should surrender to Krishna. And then one may think, well, I will surrender to Krishna, but only I must wait for his mercy. I need to wait some time. I'm not feeling that mercy. So actually, Srila Prabhupada was speaking on this. He was saying that Krishna said, he didn't say, you know, surrender unto me. he didn't say, you know, I want you to offer me a whole lot of, you know, sort of scanty reasons why you can't surrender to me. He doesn't say that in the Bhagavad Gita. I would like you to surrender unto me, but what I want to hear from you is so many good excuses why you cannot. Maybe there's some verses which they've left out. And Krishna says, you just surrender unto me like that. So, one who does that, whether they do it in full knowledge or just, you know, because Krishna says it and the acharyas say it and the devotees are doing it, either way, if one does it, one will never be enchanted by the material energy. And if one does not fix their mind on Krishna, the reality, one will always be bewildered. And a bewildered person must always suffer. And that is the... you know, why Krishna is going to so much trouble, because he doesn't want us to suffer. So I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments. If no one has any questions, it means you all agree. It's the same point that you know, just like, you know, if a father says to a child, you know, this is a microphone, you talk in this end, it'll make your voice go louder. A child doesn't know what a microphone is, they don't know how it works, but they just accept what the father says, then they're just as good as the father. Their knowledge is just as good. So they accept, yes, this is a microphone, I'll talk into this end. And when they do that, they find they get the same result that the father gets. The father talks into the microphone, it makes his voice go louder. The child just accepts what the father says, talks into the microphone, and the voice goes louder. So his knowledge produces the same effect because they accept. If the child, you know, needs to question and experiment and, you know, so many different ways, then sometimes the father may, you know, do other things to gradually bring that child to just accept, you know. Sometimes you have to show someone the things that can go wrong. Sometimes people have to see what can go wrong before they will just, you know, do the simple thing. And then they'll accept, oh, I should have just done what I was told. I'll give you an example that when I was on the farm, we had a dam created. the big dam down at the bottom of the hill, for those who've been to the farm. So we had because the water, so much water used to come through that valley, and it could pick up chunks of concrete the size of, a four-wheel drive, and just throw them 100 yards. A very, very powerful amount of water, and it actually damaged. So we had to put in a big, wall with overflow for the water, and like that. Previously, they had pipes underneath. Pipes, like 7-8 feet high, but the water just ripped the pipes out and smashed them to bits. So we decided we'd put an overflow, so it allowed the water. But for that overflow, we needed a little grass on top of one section of the dam wall. So what happened is, when we finished, unfortunately we got a big rain before the grass had grown, and it created a little gouge in where we wanted a nice grassy patch for the water to flow over the top. So to fix it, we got some advice from the farmers, and you had to put hay bales, and the water would come, and basically it collects on the hay bales and gathers dirt, and it stops just creating a huge gouge, which can end up 12 feet deep very quickly. So I had a couple of helpers, and I said to the helpers that I want you to drive the hay bales down to the dam. Don't drive the tractor over the dam wall, because it's just been built and it's a little soft like that. We've had some big rains. The square bales, not the big ones, just park the tractor there, carry them over to the gouge, put them in the ground, stake them in. So they get down there, and they decide, well, what does Gunga know? Let's experiment with our superior intelligence, and we'll do things in a different way. So why not just drive the tractor across? Is that way we don't have to carry the bales back and forth? So they did that. Of course, as soon as they basically got onto the wall, the tractor started sinking about this deep. Of course, the tyres are about that thick. So you've got gouges in the dam wall, which is not a very good thing. About that thick, two of them, and about this deep. And then they thought, we better turn around and go back. So they ended up doing a fishtail, and sort of made, and couldn't quite get into their old track, so you've got just basically just this dam wall was just absolutely decimated. So then, I went down and saw it, and I said to them, well, now you have to fix it. So I gave them a couple of shovels, and they had to fill it in. Okay. So, the difficulty that they experienced by just not being able to just take a little instruction was, unlimited trouble they caused. It was so difficult for them. And of course, the dam wall was never quite the same, but we did manage to repair it. But the same, Krishna is saying that if you think of, he says to Arjuna, you think of me and you'll pass beyond all troubles by my grace. All the problems that exist in this material world, you fix your mind upon me, you'll not be enchanted by the material energy. You'll not be bewildered, because I am the ultimate reality. See? You'll be protected by always being fixed in the reality that everything belongs to God, and that I am that person. And if you fix your mind like that, all the problems that are waiting for you, you'll overcome them very easily. But if you don't, and act forgetting me, then in this way you become bewildered, and you'll be caught in the cycle of birth and death, and so much difficulty for millions and millions and millions of lifetimes. So like that. So the point being that if people want to doubt Krishna's instruction, he offers them every possible stepping stone to help bridge that gap between the, you know, seeing Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead is a big step for a lot of people. So he offers them every stepping stone of knowledge for every level of person. So in other words, he doesn't just say that, oh, you can't understand it, you're finished. In the same way that a parent, you know, may you know, deal with a child, that if they can't understand something, they will try all the little stepping stones to somehow, but still to bring them to the same point. They don't give up. So therefore, Krishna manifests in unlimited different incarnations and expansions, which are more readily understood. Just like certain people, when they understand that nature is something, a powerful force, some of the first deities that they can relate to are deities that have partly animal forms, because to them those animal forms have a relationship with nature, and they can accept, yes, that slightly animal type form, like in the ancient Egypt, you see, you know, with the eagle's head or the cat's or what have you. It helps them to, they're appreciating nature, and they can appreciate the relationship between that deity which has some form like nature, whereas if you tell them that, you know, the Supreme is a cowherd boy, it's just too much of a jump. But gradually all the different expansions of the Lord and incarnations, step by step, bring us to understand a more superior feature. And when we understand that, we can understand the next superior level. Ultimately, when we understand the Lord in full, we can appreciate that he just likes to have fun with his devotees in the spiritual world. And therefore, he just runs around Vrindavan barefoot playing games and you know, having fun with his, you know, that's what God does. Why would he, you know, what would God be doing in the spiritual world? Making factories and putting everyone to work, or, you know. You know, if he's God, you know, he's not going to spend all of eternity sitting in front of a big black dot book putting ticks and crosses. You know, we can imagine everyone else goes to heaven to enjoy, and God's got to sit there just watching and putting ticks and crosses. That's his eternity. But I'm going to heaven to enjoy. You know, you have to understand, if he is the Supreme Lord, then he, what does he do with his creation? He is the enjoyer of creation. The enjoyer of creation means that he expands himself unlimitedly, and in those unlimited expansions, personal expansions and separated expansions, which is us, he enjoys so many different loving relationships and loving activities. And all of those relationships can be accommodated in Krishna's form, his most beautiful, most approachable. This is what Queen Kunti said in her prayers, that of all the incarnations, of all the forms of the Lord, you're the most approachable. So, you know, when the Supreme Lord enjoys in the spiritual world, he does it by being easily approached. And very attractive at this. So that is the form of Krishna. But to come to the point to understand that God is actually enjoying with his friends and associates that have expanded from himself in the spiritual world is a huge leap for people. They imagine that they can more easily, readily accept that he is this face, that he, you know, old man with some shroud, you know, some light bulb for a head that's always glowing, you know, or he has, you know, so many different, they can, or that he is nothing, he has no form. They can imagine anything but the form of Krishna. Even though the form of Krishna is the most natural and attractive, that if you thought, what would you like God to be like? Would you like him to be this, you know, wonderful person that you can walk up and hug and play with and talk to? Or do you want him to be a light bulb head, you know, always too busy putting ticks and crosses in books? Or to be a nothing? Or to be, you know, some form that has the head like an eagle and the feet like a chicken? You know, if you were to meet God, the most attractive form, that yes, there's Krishna, let me go and, you know, live in the beautiful natural surroundings of Vrindavan and the spiritual world. And even though that's the most attractive, it's the hardest possible thing for people to accept. Even though that's within their heart of hearts, that's all they want. And although that's the natural desire, it's very difficult to understand. So therefore Krishna makes so many different stepping stones so that we can, you know, come to that understanding. Alright, any other questions or comments? Jai Ho, Guru Srila Prabhupada.